Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the landslide presidential election of the billionaire chocolate king Petro Poroshenko in Ukraine and the European Parliament elections that produced an alarming influx of far-right representatives from 28 European countries, in particular Britain, Denmark, France and Greece. Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council and is now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, joins us to assess Poroshenko's military offensive against armed secessionists in eastern Ukraine and the new crop of xenophobes and racists with a sprinkling of neo-Nazis who were just elected across Europe. Then we'll look into Tuesday's 4-1 vote by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to kill further study of moving dangerously radioactive spent fuel from cooling pools at nuclear power plants to safer dry casks. An internationally recognized expert on nuclear terrorism and proliferation and power plant safety and security, Edward Lyman, joins us. He is a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we will discuss the dangerous density of spent fuel at overcrowded cooling pools in the US that poses a safety risk that would dwarf the economic and social disruption caused by the Fukushima meltdowns. Then finally, once again, we'll visit the deadly intersection of mental health and easy access to automatic firearms following the latest gun massacre in Santa Barbara, and speak with Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who is the director of the country's only mental health law practice dealing with families with members who are potential risks to society and themselves. And also joining us to discuss the culpability of the NRA and the entertainment business in arming and influencing the shooter is John Donahue, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He is now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His books include Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace, and No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Glad to be with you.
And this sort of right-wing sweep in the European elections, of course, has alarmed the political establishments in most of the European countries. And it sort of is in contrast to the absolute drubbing that the right wing got in the Ukrainian elections. Of course, Russia has made a great deal about the idea that the Ukraine has been taken over by fascists and neo-Nazis. But the far-right-wing parties in the Ukrainian election only got 2% of the vote. What's your sense then, just to start with Ukraine, of Petro Poroshenko's sudden move to oust the pro-Russian separatists, particularly at the airport in Donetsk?
Well, I think the election on Sunday turned out well for Ukrainians and also for the Western democracies that have been hoping to pull Ukraine in a westward direction. Not only did he win in the first round because he got more than 50%, but he won in a landslide. Yulia Tymoshenko, the former prime minister, only got about 13% of the vote. And so to the degree that this is a president with a mandate, one can begin to see the country hanging together. And that is by no means a foregone conclusion. He has been using a lot of force in the past 24 hours against separatists that took over a regional airport in the eastern part of the country. From what we can gather, the Ukrainian military has succeeded in wresting control of that airfield, and the separatists have been dealt a pretty serious blow. A lot of them have been killed. And even while he's doing that, he's reaching out to Moscow. He has been talking in the last 24 hours about getting together with Putin. He knows Putin. And so this could be a guy who was able to press the fight against the separatists and at the same time craft a reasonably good working relationship with the Kremlin.
But do you think he can that such a relationship is possible if Putin's bottom line is that the Ukraine has to accept his annexation of Crimea? And furthermore, it would seem that given the claim on the $2.5 billion that Ukraine owes Russia or Gazprom for back, the gas that they've already used, one wonders whether who's going to end up paying for that, because Ukraine's economy is in a downward spiral. Its currency has lost 30% of its value this year, and its largest trading partner is, of course, Russia.
Well, he's got his work cut out for him, as you just outlined, and he is going to be the head of a country that has been dysfunctional ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Its institutions, its economy, its politicians have never really made the transition toward a fully functional liberal democratic state with a capitalist economy. So he's got a lot of work to do. But I do think that that Crimea is not going to be a make-or-break issue. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's off the table, but I think that given how much water is under the bridge, Poroshenko probably is not going to expend a huge amount of political capital on that issue. Instead, I think he's going to try to decentralize power, to give those eastern regions that are more pro-Russian the feeling that they have a wide berth and that the western part of the country wants to keep them in and give them the autonomy they want. And that may well satisfy Putin enough that he strikes a deal on continued supply of gas. And the IMF and the European Union have already, because they've been on the ground in Ukraine for the last few months, set up programs to get aid to Ukraine pretty quickly. Some of that aid may well go to paying off debts to Russia.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and is now a Professor of International Affairs in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and the author of No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. So if Europe is to bail out Ukraine and ironically, perhaps some European and U.S. Money may end up in Putin's coffers. Is there any expectation on Europe's part that since they're bailing this country out, that it would then reintroduce the EU deal that basically triggered this whole crisis?
Yes, and Poroshenko has stated as much. The outline of that deal remains to be seen, but the president-elect has indicated that he plans to proceed with political and economic deals that would attach Ukraine to Europe in a way that it's never been. But I think the trick is to do so in a way that does not appear to the Russians to be a zero-sum game. And he's talked about, for example, moving ahead with a political and economic deal with the European Union and at the same time having a free trade area with the Russians. And I think that is really the only way forward. The idea that somehow Ukraine, a country that has been attached to Russia culturally, politically, commercially, religiously, for centuries, is going to sort of turn its back and walk away, that's simply not on. That won't happen, and it would probably trigger some kind of rash action by the Russians. And so I think Poroshenko is right in trying to portray Ukraine as a country that's going to be in a geopolitical, not no man's land, but affiliate with the West at the same time that it maintains its ties to Russia.
So turning to the European elections, Charles Kupchan, in Denmark, Britain, France, and Greece, as well as Austria, Sweden, and Hungary, there were surprising gains from the far right, in particular in France. Le Pen's party came out ahead of everybody, as did Nigel Farage in the UK, which must be a huge surprise to the British establishment and in Britain in general, where the country's always been considered extremely tolerant. Lafarge is mockingly the British establishment is saying the mainstream politicians are like goldfish that have been tipped out of their bowl onto the floor and are gasping for air. So what do you make of this extraordinary populist right-wing surge in Europe?
Well, it is extraordinary, and it's worrisome. You know, for starters, the one thing that I would say off the get-go is that most of these parties are not dark 1930s kinds of populists. There are a few: the Jobbik Party in Hungary, Golden Dawn in Greece. These parties represent anti-Semitism. They are proto-fascist. They are neo-Nazis of sorts. They did gain strength, and they are dangerous. Elsewhere in Europe, what we've seen is both right-wing and left-wing populists surge. And as you said, Ian, in Britain and in France, two of the largest countries in Europe, these populist right-wing parties actually came out on top. Now, the implications of those victories are limited in the sense that these votes were for the European Parliament. These countries will send these right-wing politicians to Brussels, to the European Parliament, and that is a body that has limited power. It is more consultative than it is legislative. But what it does say is that it's possible that in a national election, one of these parties could win. It's possible that the National Front could win the French election, and you could have a president of France who represents a far-right populist, anti-immigrant, anti-EU agenda. We're not there yet. I don't think that we're going to get there, but the strength of the votes for these parties in right across Europe is quite striking, and it will create a European Parliament that has 25% to 30% of its members questioning the union itself. It would be a little bit like holding an election in the United States and having 25% of the U.S. Congress wondering whether the union was a good thing.
And, of course, the idea that the European Union is inevitable, immutable, you know, that very core belief is now shaken, isn't it?
It is. You know, I think that what's happened here is that, you know, for most of its history, the European Union, it used to be called the European Economic Community, the Common Market, kind of flew below the radar screen. It wasn't a big deal in domestic politics. Elites, day by day, pushed the baby forward, and they went from a single market and then to a single currency not too long ago, the so-called euro. And domestic electorates kind of went along for the ride. What has happened over the last decade is that people have woken up to Europe. They're talking about it in restaurants, on the street, and they're saying unkind things about it. So the European Union has been politicized, and you can't really put the genie back in the bottle. And it's a combination of immigration, unemployment, economic downturn, a union that went from 12 to 16 and now 28 members, so it lost its core identity. All of these things have led to a souring among European electorates in the sense that the European institutions and the European street aren't in sync anymore. Now, the big question is this a blip? Is this a temporary detour that is a function of the Eurozone crisis, or has the European Union hit its high water mark, and in the years ahead, it is going to either just stay where it is now or perhaps even unravel? We don't know the answer to that, but the mere fact that we are asking that question does, as you put it, shake the foundations of the European experiment.
And how much do you think the prolonged European financial crisis has led to this disquiet, if not rebellion, in Europe, given the austerity that was imposed and how much it's backfired and essentially, you know, the average European, particularly in Greece and Spain and Italy and other countries, have basically been punished because of, you know, corrupt governments and banks not doing their due diligence.
No question that the Eurozone crisis and the austerity that came with it have led to the populism, have made many Europeans say, why are we doing this? What is the point of European integration if, in fact, we're worse off and not better off? But the reality is that this turn started before the financial crisis. I think you could date it to 2005 when a referendum was held on a new European constitution, and it was rejected in both the Netherlands and in France. I see it as not just about the downturn in the economy, but as a larger reaction to globalization, to European integration, to the sense that voters have lost a certain amount of control over their destiny. And they're now saying to their politicians, we want to wrest control back. We want national borders to be national boundaries again. We want to have control over who's coming in and who's going out. And so in many respects, it's not just about European integration. It is in some ways a conflation of the penetration of the traditional nation state, both by globalization and by the strictures of the European Union.
But what didn't seem to happen in this election, and given the caveats about its importance that you've given us, Charles Kupchan, is that I don't see a reflection of any disquiet over what's happening in Russia and Ukraine, any sense of their vulnerability over Russian gas, the idea that NATO should be beefed up. That doesn't seem to be on the table.
You're right, and it's interesting. Perhaps a little bit troubling. I would have thought a couple of months ago that what the Russians have done in Ukraine would temper the populism in Europe and help Europeans rediscover the magic of the European Union, which is essentially rid Western and Central Europe of war. National boundaries don't matter anymore geopolitically, and the European Union is one of the main reasons. But the trouble in Ukraine and the bearing of the Russian teeth don't seem to have done that. And I was in Germany last week, and I have to say that I was particularly surprised by the public debate in Germany about Ukraine, a sense of much, much greater empathy and sympathy with Russia than you hear in the United States. Part of it historic, part of it guilt about the number of Russians that died in World War II, and also just hardcore interests. Germany is much more closely integrated with Russia economically in terms of gas, in terms of exports, than the United States. And as a consequence, the Germans were, I think, hopeful of getting out of this crisis without a serious breach with Russia. Given what happened in Ukraine over the weekend, these elections, the Germans may actually get what they want.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here, Charles Kupchan.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And his latest book is No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and the Coming Global Turn. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the U.S. is ignoring growing risks at its nuclear power plants.
Tell all you fascists you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one.
The Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole less truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edwin Lyman, who is a senior scientist at the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists and an internationally recognized expert on nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism, as well as nuclear power safety and security. The former president of the Nuclear Control Institute, he has testified numerous times before Congress and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edwin Lyman.
Good evening.
And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission today, Tuesday, announced that four of its five members voted to decline further consideration of a plan to expedite transferring spent nuclear fuel from cooling pools to dry casks in U.S. nuclear power plants. And, of course, the lone vote to continue the study was cast by the NRC chair, Allison McFarland. So, what do you make of that that sort of blindness, if you will, to the risks of these pools, given what happened at Fukushima?
Yes, this is an issue that our organization has been working on for quite some time. Because of the federal government's failure to come up with a plan for nuclear waste at reactors, spent fuel is accumulating in swimming pool-type structures, which were not built for the capacity that they now hold. So there's much more fuel in those pools than they were designed to actually store. And the problem is that spent fuel remains very hot for a very long time. It has to be continuously cooled. And if that cooling is interrupted for some period of time, the spent fuel could actually catch fire, burn, melt, and release a lot of radioactivity.
And I take it the fact that there's more of these very, very hot rods in these pools means that they have to circulate more water. And what happens to that water? Is it recycled?
Well, typically it's recycled as under normal operations. But as we saw at Fukushima, if you run into a situation where you don't have access to normal cooling, you have to resort to emergency measures. And at Fukushima, they did everything from trying to drop water from helicopters into the spent fuel pools to use police water cannon and eventually large concrete spraying machines that they filled with water, which finally did the trick. But even to this day, they are pumping water into the reactors and the spent fuel pools at Fukushima, and much of it is becoming contaminated and leaking out again into the groundwater. So you don't want to end up in that kind of a situation.
Well, I don't know whether you saw the piece on Vice, the new show on HBO that's sort of like a 60 Minutes type of news magazine show. They did a piece on Fukushima, and I must say it was really alarming. It suggested that both TEPCO, the power plant owners in Japan, and the federal Japanese government have been for the longest time engaged in a kind of cover-up, and the full scope of the disaster has really not been either dawned on the Japanese public, or they haven't been informed of its severity.
Well, one of the consequences of the accident was there's a fairly large region that is contaminated with cesium-137, which is a radioactive isotope which persists in the environment for a very long time and is quite hazardous. And if you have a lot of cesium-137 lying around, it creates a situation that's not habitable. So there are about 150,000 people who were evacuated in the months after the accident who still can't return to their homes. And the question is really how much do you have to clean up this area before you can send people back in to live there again? And the answer seems to be no one's willing to clean it up to the standards it was before the accident. So if people want to move back, they're going to have to expect more radioactive exposure for the rest of their lives.
But during the Fukushima accident, I remember I think it was unit number 4 there was a great deal of alarm that the fuel rods were going to explode. You already had the huge explosions as two or three of them, the reactors melted down. My understanding is that the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they've done studies on the vulnerability of these swimming pools at U.S. nuclear power plants. And if an accident or terrorist attack happens here in the United States, my understanding is that the resulting explosion and fires of the burning fuel rods could create would dwarf the economic and social disruption caused by the Fukushima disaster.
Well, that's quite possible because the amount of radioactive material in a typical spent fuel pool could be several times the amount that was in the reactor cores at Fukushima, because we've been piling this stuff up for decades. And so, for instance, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's study on the consequences of a spent fuel pool fire found that in the worst case they looked at, you could have something like 50 times the amount of cesium being released from the single spent fuel pool than was released from the three damaged reactors at Fukushima. And that could lead to an area maybe 10 times what the interdicted area or the exclusion zone around Fukushima is because of that contamination, and affecting 10 times or even 100 times as many people.
So how does this explain then, Edward Lyman, again, a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists and an internationally recognized expert on nuclear proliferation, nuclear terrorism, as well as nuclear power safety and security? The NRC chairwoman, Alison McFarlane, who was the only vote to continue this study as to reduce the amount of fuel rods in these pools and put them in dry casks for storage. And by the way, in order to move these fuel rods from nuclear power plants, they'd have to do that. They'd have to put them in these dry casks. That's what other countries do. But she said wrote in her commentary, according to this NRC staff study, that reducing the density of spent fuel in a pool at the Peach Bottom nuclear plant in Pennsylvania, for example, could lower the human health consequences of zirconium fire by more than a factor of 10, and the number of individuals who may have to abandon their homes by a factor of 50, and the economic cost by $100 billion. So how come that this doesn't get the attention of all the four commissioners who voted against continuing the study? Why are they so lackadaisical?
Well, what the other commissioners have fallen back on is the old reliance on the claim that an accident so bad that it could cause a severe spent fuel pool fire is so improbable that we don't have to really worry about it. It's the "it can't happen here" attitude that we think greatly contributed to the mindset that caused Fukushima. We think that to really address the lessons of Fukushima, a nuclear regulator has to have a more skeptical approach toward nuclear safety, to question their own assumptions, to question dubious mathematics on the part of their staff, and to err on the side of caution. And we see the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in this vote, as well as many others after Fukushima, as not really heeding that lesson. They're relying on a very narrow set of circumstances. They've convinced themselves that the type of accident is just so improbable, it's not likely to happen. So why should we make the industry spend a lot of money trying to deal with it if it's never going to happen? And the problem is that you simply can't rely on that kind of analysis, and that's what Fukushima has shown us.
But doesn't this also point, Edward Lyman, to what is wrong with nuclear power and the entire premise of the nuclear industry. To this date, since the dawn of the nuclear age, they still don't know what to do with nuclear waste. That's, you know, that's the sort of 900-pound gorilla, isn't it? I mean, there's no national depository. The one in Nevada has been closed, or it won't ever be activated because of local political pressure. As we mentioned, that this nuke fuel rods are normally stored in dry casks, which are much safer than putting them in a swimming pool next to the power plant, where a terrorist could drive by and shoot a hole with an RPG and drain the pool, and then you'd have, you know, something considerably worse than Fukushima.
Well, yes. I mean, the accumulation of spent fuel at reactors is, like I said, a direct result of a failure of national policy. And the problem is you can't just bury nuclear waste in any old hole in the ground. You really have to come up with a safety case to show that it can be disposed of safely for the duration in which it will remain hazardous, which is hundreds of thousands a year. So it's not easy to make that kind of a demonstration, and that's the problem the U.S. ran into it at Yucca Mountain. However, the consequence of that is if you don't get it underground, then you have to deal with accumulations of spent fuel above ground, and as long as it's going to be above ground, you should come up with a scheme where you're going to minimize the risk that there'll be a lot of radiation exposure to the public from that waste. So you have to find the least bad of a bunch of bad alternatives, and that, we believe, is moving spent fuel from overcrowded pools into dry casks.
So what's going to happen now that this study's been killed? And it's a study. It's not even reached the point of a vote or a recommendation or a mandate.
That's right. The question before the commission was only should we continue to study the issue, and the majority said, oh, we already know enough. There's no point in wasting any more time looking at it. We'll continue to advocate for change. The NRC isn't the only game in town. There's also Congress, and we know that certain senators especially are very upset about spent fuel. They have to deal with shutdown reactors in their states, including California and the San Onofre reactors. And the problem is it's very hard to get a political constituency today for enhancing nuclear safety, because the industry is very effective and a lobbyist, and they are waging a campaign to try to forestall a decline in their fortunes as a result of a drop in natural gas prices, which is really threatening the viability of nuclear power.
Well, Edward Lyman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Edward Lyman, who is a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists and an internationally recognized expert on nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism, as well as nuclear power safety and security. He's the former president of the Nuclear Control Institute, and he's testified numerous times before Congress and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back once again visiting the deadly intersection of mental health and easy access to automatic firearms.
I wanted to walk through the empty streets and feel something constant under my feet, but all the news reports recommended that I stay indoors, because the air outside will make ourselves divide.
Bye.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who's a partner in the law firm of Abrams & Fensterman, where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice, concentrating in the areas of mental health and healthcare law. She's also the founder and president of Campus Behavioral Health Risk Consultants and is a former hospital administrator and director of hospital risk management. And also joining us is John J. Donahue III, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy, and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf and John J. Donahue III.
Hi. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let me begin with you, Carolyn. Once again, we're at the deadly intersection of mental health and easy access to automatic firearms. Obviously, the April 30th meeting at the apartment building, which later ended up being the crime scene where three young Chinese students were hacked to death by the shooter who ended up killing seven people, including himself, and wounding 13 others. On April 30th, I think seven Santa Barbara deputies visited him because of phone calls from concerned parents and therapists. And yet they were not able to determine. Obviously, one can't expect police to be psychiatrist, but they weren't able to determine that he was a danger to society. And the shooter himself, in his manifesto, breathed a sigh of relief that they didn't come in and search the place and find the weapons and ammunition and therefore destroy his plan to massacre people. So, again, what's your sense of that failure and how can it be addressed and redressed?
Well, I think the laws have to change. I think we need, in light of all of these tragedies we've seen in the last several years among young people, the laws need to change and sort of shift the balance between individual rights and privacy and the safety and security of the community. I think we need to begin to give law enforcement more latitude when they respond to these calls and to allow more information to be exchanged back and forth from family members who are concerned about their loved ones when they're exhibiting symptoms or saying things or writing things that are of concern and are a potential danger to themselves and to other people.
And John Donahue, this is a bit like a kind of grim version of Groundhog Day. Every time we talk, there's been a massacre, and they happen frequently, obviously. But my recollection is that the Virginia Tech massacre was preceded by a similar visit of people looking into the mental health of the shooter in that incident, and yet he was able to buy weapons, as was Elliot Rodger.
Yes, the Virginia Tech system was yet another one of the cases where there was ample evidence of a severe mental illness. In that case, there was a different sort of breakdown. In the Virginia Tech case, he actually should have been on the list of proscribed purchasers so that he would not have been able to secure the weapons that he used in that massacre. But Virginia at the time was rather lax in transmitting that information, and it never got into the system. Virginia has actually tried to improve the way in which people who are identified in the very narrow class of individuals who are preempted to buy guns by virtue of their mental illness get classified into the system. But what we need to do is not only ensure that once you do meet the criteria for being a prohibited purchaser, the information gets into the system, but we also need to greatly expand the number of prohibited purchasers, if the truth be told. If we really want to take measures to prevent major shooting tragedies, much more has to be done to keep guns away from people who do pose a great risk to themselves and to others.
But the NRA spends a lot of time on Capitol Hill reducing the effectiveness of the ATF. It took them 7 years to even get a leader, and also the FBI. So they're the ones that seem to be trying to stop any kind of list on people who buy guns.
Well, you have to remember that more crime means more sales for gun merchants in the U.S. So the NRA has a very strong vested interest in trying to prevent anything that will either limit sales to criminals or reduce crime in other dimensions. The 8 years of Bill Clinton's administration were horrible years for the NRA because crime fell so dramatically that gun sales fell very dramatically. And so they definitely do not have the same interest that the American public has in trying to reduce the amount of crime. And in fact, they benefit directly by anything that elevates the fears and concerns of the public at large. Again, you listen to the NRA and their solution to the problem of things like the shooting in Santa Barbara is to encourage, you know, the sorority sisters to carry around more weapons. It really is not a sensible way of dealing with this particular problem.
Again, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, a partner in the law firm of Abrahams and Fensterman, where she's director of the firm's mental health law practice, and she's also the founder and president of Campus Behavioral Risk Consultants. Tell me, Caroline, about protocols that you know about that could have been in place to prevent this killing, given the failure of the police. And obviously, as I mentioned, we can't expect our police to be psychiatrists.
Well, no, that's true. I mean, my concern is that every time we have one of these tragedies, the main issue we should be talking about is mental health treatment, being proactive, being being, you know, able to intervene sooner, being preventive. And it always gets diverted to the issue of gun control. And not that that isn't something important and something we need to do, but I think as a society in this country, we need to start to look at how important and how much the main issue is mental health. We need to fund it. We need to set up programs to intervene sooner. We have a private psychiatric intervention team in my practice. So we can go in and spend more time. We go in knowing what the background is and what the concerns of the family are. We get information from the family that the law doesn't allow to happen very often when people get hospitalized or are in treatment, all of our confidentiality laws, which are really used as a wall between loved ones and people who have most information and history to not be able to share with those who are in a position to intervene early and provide treatment. So the issue, you know, the subject needs to be about making mental health a priority, fund it, do education and training. There's a lot of misinformation out there about what our laws really are and what the exceptions to these laws are and how they can be useful. And we need to have more ability to intervene privately with the goal of getting people the treatment that they need.
But in terms of the broad societal responsibility, you mentioned that gun control is the issue that comes up when these mass shootings take place and that there should be more focus on psychiatric help to prevent such tragedies. It also seems to me that while the NRA has plenty to be blamed for, in many ways, I think culturally, Hollywood, where I'm calling you from, is also to blame with these endless movies with people poking guns and TV shows with, you know, there's hardly a TV show without somebody running around poking a gun, opening doors, and all this kind of macho nonsense. I mean, let me just read you what from the manifesto of this shooter to give you a sense of what I'm trying to get at here in terms of the cultural acceptance of guns. Guns are something that solve problems, that make you a man. The Gun Maker Cult on its website page talks about the founder. Abe Lincoln may have freed all men, but Sam Colt made them equal. And clearly this shooter felt the possession of a gun made him a man. Just quoting what he wrote, "After I picked up the handgun, I brought it back to my room and felt a new sense of power. I was now armed. Who's the alpha male now, bitches? I thought to myself regarding all of the girls who'd looked down on me in the past." So is that, do you accept that thesis that we as a society, as a culture, have turned guns not into instruments of shame, but instruments of power.
I think that's true. I think, in fact, we have done that. I think we've also now have a society that is so unrealistic about what guns do. You know, the video games, the TV shows, you know, you shoot people today and they don't die. They come back tomorrow. So I think, you know, the young people aren't realistic about what guns do. And yes, maybe it creates this sense of power and manhood. Although, look at the more recent tragedies. They were stabbing. This person stabbed his roommate, that high school in Colorado. He came in stabbing people. So again, my argument would be it's not just about the guns. It's about the sensitivity to violence. It's also about the fact that people need treatment in order to desensitize them and to get them, you know, to a sense of reality where they're not taking these actions.
And John Donahue III, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. In terms of the NRA, one of the parents of the boy, the young man that was killed at the deli, he railed against the NRA and gutless, feckless politicians under the sway of the NRA. What's your sense in terms of culpability, not just to the NRA, but also to Hollywood and the general culture that glorifies guns and treats them as a means by which somebody can establish their manhood and settle their problems?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a very unfortunate part of our culture. And if you look at the people like Adam Lanza and Elliot Rodgers, they are the sort of feckless men who do aggrandize themselves through acquisition of arms, which is obviously very unfortunate. But I think that there are, you know, so many problems here that need to be addressed. Obviously, the NRA has a lot to be blameworthy about. But as Caroline mentioned, there is this broader problem of, you know, violence on the part of mentally disturbed individuals. Although, again, we see that for Elliot Rodgers, this was a person coming from a family that had a lot of access to treatment and was a wealthy family. I mean, he was driving around a BMW. So the normal concerns about a poor individual not having access to mental health treatment were not invoked in this case. And, of course, the Adam Lanza situation was very similar, a very affluent family. But there you saw the hallmarks of the sort of NRA attitude operating in a very dangerous and damaging way, where the mother was actually sort of miming NRA attitudes about the value of having guns and was actually planning on buying another gun for Adam Lanza for Christmas just a few weeks after the tragedy that occurred there. So we do need to work on many different fronts to address the violence problem. But one thing I think is important to get out there is just the message of how useless guns are so much of the time. If you listen to the NRA, you would think, boy, if you have a gun, you're safe, you're going to be protected. But a huge percentage of people who actually do get shot or killed or otherwise severely injured in violent crime do have guns, and they're completely feckless in addressing the attacks on them. The real serious violent criminals disarm you before you have an opportunity to use a gun. So I think it's important to get that message out there. Having a gun for self-protection most of the time is a completely useless waste of your money and does pose a danger to yourself and others.
And Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, in terms of the parents, and just for disclosure, I know the father of the shooter, and I actually had him on my program once. He'd made a feature documentary about how different cultures around the world see God. He's a filmmaker. But the fact that they were able to afford therapists, et cetera, and yet there was this horrible failure. What are the deficiencies there? What are the structural problems there?
Well, I think the laws need to change. You know, the confidentiality laws need to be modified. The legal standard for involuntary commitment is very restrictive. It was, they were designed for the years when there were very serious abuses in the mental health system and psychiatric hospitals. That, for the most part, does not exist anymore. It's outlived its usefulness. So that has to be changed in order to address what we're seeing in our society now and to, of course, have safeguards on those. But they need to yield to the community safety and security. There also is a lot of misinformation, and there are not a lot of attorneys out there. I mean, I'm really the only attorney who has a practice like this in the country, who specializes in mental health law and working with families and individuals to utilize the legal system and the clinical system as a team approach, to get people engaged and into treatment and work with families and educate them as to what services are available. What we can utilize in the different systems to do psychiatric in-home interventions separate from law enforcement, who, again, are restricted by the legal system. In addition, we need much, much more, you know, funding for training and education so that people do know realistically what the system can offer in terms of assistance and health and education and what it can. And families really are at a loss to know how to navigate through the mental health system, the healthcare system, and so on, to get the intervention and the treatment that their loved ones need and that they're very familiar with and know they need.
But my understanding, Carolyn, is that Adam Lanza, the shooter massacred all those students. Apparently his mother tried to have him committed just 2 weeks before Adam Lanza massacred those school children at Sandy Hook Elementary School. But the beds were full, and instead they gave him a prescription of Zyprexa.
Right, which is an antipsychotic medication. And yes, that's another issue. Again, it comes down to funding and services. There are a shortage of psychiatric beds. There's a shortage of psychiatrists being trained in mental and programs for mental health professionals to be trained. So that whole part of the system needs to expand also to accommodate those people who could benefit from treatment, need to be in treatment, and, you know, for whom we can intervene earlier on.
And John Donahue, just to Caroline's point about emptying the mental hospitals back when Ronald Reagan was governor here in California, it was under the notion that the people were being kept against their will and that it was done in terms of freedom of the individual and their rights as opposed to societal problems that followed. I mean, since Ronald Reagan emptied the mental hospital here in California, we've had parks in this state, you know, Santa Monica, the home of the homeless, full of clearly mentally ill people. So my sense is that they were just dumped on society, and how can anybody argue that they're better off?
Yeah, the treatment of the mentally ill in this country has been appalling, both in the earlier days of mistreatment in the mental hospitals and now the dumping of them out onto the street and also into our prisons. We sort of substituted mass incarceration of the mentally ill for mass incarceration of people convicted of crimes. And so our prisons have become, you know, warehouses of the mentally ill as well. It's not a good system in almost any way that you define it. I would just throw one other point in there that, of course, all of the affluent countries around the world do have, you know, similar problems of numbers of mentally ill individuals. But at least in terms of mass shootings, let me just throw out one success story. Australia, which used to have a higher rate of mass shootings than the United States, has not had a single one since they engaged in their very aggressive gun control after the 1995 shootings or 1996 shootings in Australia. So as an intermediate step between getting people into some sort of warehousing treatment, you could just be sure to take away their guns. Think of what would have happened if the police had been authorized to go to Roger and say, we have to be sure that you don't have any weapons because we think you're a danger to yourself and others. As his manifesto showed, that would have put an end to the entire episode here.
So, Carolyn,
I want to be clear that, you know, we have enough stigma in this country that prevents people from going into treatment or staying in treatment, and that statistically people with serious mental illness are much more often the victims of violence than the perpetrators of violence. That doesn't take away from the need for mental health treatment in general, regardless of what the diagnosis is or what you call it. You know, there are still serious mental health issues in general that need to be addressed.
And just a quick comment on what happened here in California with under Governor Reagan. Has it gone too far in the opposite direction of just dumping people on the streets?
Yes. What happened was is we opened the doors to our chronic mental psychiatric hospitals, and there was nothing on the receiving end. There's no funding even today, or very little, for outpatient programs, outpatient therapists, support systems, case management. All of the different pieces of puzzle that we put together are not available out there. So you open the doors and you put people back into the community, but you didn't offer them any support services or treatment. And that's where the system took a very serious failure turn to failure.
Well, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, I thank you very much for joining us, as well as you, John Donahue.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who's a partner in the law firm of Abrahamson Fensterman, where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice, concentrating in the areas of mental health and healthcare law. She's also the founder and president of Campus Behavioral Health Risk Consultants and is a former hospital administrator and director of hospital risk management. And also joining us was John J. Donahue, the third, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.